Well, hello, everybody. This is a workshop, so if you're in here on accident, you have other options than to be with me, but I'm glad to see you. So it's a little funny to be in a workshop on the stage, so just imagine we're in a small, intimate room kind of chatting about these things. So what I want to do is talk about the parables. Now, I've got a handout for you, but I want to wait to give it to you because it's got colors on it, and I don't want to distract you right now. I want to wait, and I'll have my wife help me pass that out. So I want to talk about the people of the parables. The reason why I say this is controversial is because many sections of the Bible are controversial, but it seems to me the parables are not only accidentally controversial, but they're kind of supposed to be. I mean, Jesus shared the parables for a certain certain set of reasons that we're going to see today, and you'll see what I mean as we go along. So I want to look at some passages, mostly in Matthew, because that's where a large amount of the parables are, and Jesus actually tells us a good bit about why he taught in parables. Let me see if this is working. It is. So notice what he says in Matthew 13. He says, all these things, this is Matthew speaking, all these things Jesus spoke to the multitude in parables. And without a parable, he did not speak to them. Now, I'll tell you what's interesting to me is Jesus kind of does straight talk for a number of chapters in Matthew. Like the first section of chapters, he's telling both the crowds, he's telling disciples, he's telling them things that make sense, that are pretty straightforward. I mean, think about the Sermon on the Mount. I mean, it's instructions. It's not easy to follow necessarily, but it's instructions. He's pretty straightforward in what he's talking about. But there comes this point in Matthew where he begins to be a little bit more elusive. He kind of shifts into this parable format. And so at this point in Matthew 13, it tells us that that became his modus operandi with the crowds. So he spoke differently with his disciples, and we'll see that. But with the crowds, he began to speak in parables. So why did Jesus teach in parables? What was the purpose of that? Well, luckily, we don't have to guess. All these things, Jesus spoke to the multitude in parables, and without a parable, he did not speak to them. Notice the part that's hidden by the ellipsis there, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the prophet, saying, I will open my mouth in parables, I will utter things kept secret from the foundation of the world. So we find out that the prophet was actually talking about this time. And by the way, Matthew is packed with these little nuggets of telling us, here's something a prophet said, here's how it has come to fulfillment. So that's Matthew 13, 34 and 35. So what we see that in yellow, he says, I will utter things kept secret from the foundation of the world. So the first thing that we see about parables is that they reveal heavenly secrets. But certainly that's not the whole story, right? Because they still seem sort of elusive and sort of difficult to understand for many people. But there's something about parables that are designed to reveal heavenly secrets, the things that have been locked up for generation upon generation. So here's what we see. And the disciples came and said to him, why do you speak to them in parables? Do you notice that the disciples are asking the same thing that we're asking today? I mean, they are confused. So it wasn't really obvious to them why he spoke in parables. They were wondering as well, why are you doing this? And I think it's possible that they noticed the shift, right? Because, I mean, Matthew is the one that wrote this down. He wrote down a number of things that Jesus said very directly to the crowds, but then suddenly he begins to change. I mean, we might say gradually, it might have been a transition, but he begins to change. And the disciples want to understand why. Why are you doing this, Jesus? And so we have a little bit more information on why it's going on. He answered and said to them, because it has been given to you to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been given. Okay, so we said that the parables, they reveal heavenly mysteries, but not to everybody, apparently. Because for the disciples and those that come to Jesus in this way, it's for them to see these mysteries revealed. But there is a group that it's not designed for them to see. It's designed to be elusive for a certain group. And that is really interesting to me. You'll notice that there's a you and them in this verse or in these verses. So we might would want to know who is the you and the them. I mean, who are we talking about? I think we can make sense of this pretty easily. The disciples are who ask. So when he says you, he's talking to the disciples. And so presumably the them there is the crowds, or to use Matthew's word, the multitudes. And so there's a division between the disciples. And I would say in this case, the disciples and probably that other group of people who were close to Jesus, right? So disciples and others that get that personal time with him, that fellowship with him. There's a difference between what they get and what the crowds get. So there we go. Father, you have hidden, and this is a couple of chapters before, but it illustrates this idea. Father, you have hidden these things from the wise and prudent and have revealed them to babies. Now, do you think that when Jesus said this, the disciples realized, am I the wise or am I the babies in that sentence? I think what he's saying basically to the disciples and those that are coming to him is, hey, you're not the number one draft pick here, but you know, I'm gonna use you guys. And so he kind of makes this division. Now, when he says wise, I think he's using it sarcastically, right? Because he's talking about sort of the wisdom of the world. Those ones, those PhDs, those ones that are kind of at the top of the academic heap. He didn't use them. And that's kind of what we would expect, right? Why didn't Jesus come to the universities, pull all the PhDs together and say, okay, here's how it's going to work? It's not what he did. What he did is he used very average people, people he actually calls babies. And so that is how Jesus is revealing his message. So maybe I have to do this. There it is. Okay, I got a point right there. Okay. But God chose the foolish. This is in Corinthians. But God chose the foolish things of the world to confound the wise. We kind of see that same concept between the wise, sarcastically the wise, and the foolish. Here's another. No. Yeah, there we go. Unless you are converted and become as little children, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. So, by the way, that's entrance into heaven. But then he also acknowledges that it's not only kingdom entrance that requires this childlike faith. Notice what he says after that. He says, therefore, whoever humbles himself as a little child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. So not only is entrance required, not only is it required for entrance into the kingdom of heaven to have this childlike faith, sort of this baby mentality, this accepting mindset, it also is required for maturing and growing. And that seems kind of counterintuitive when we think about it, but this is what Jesus is telling us, is both entrance and abundance in the kingdom is going to require us to have that kind of faith. Now, the reason why I'm moving closer to you is because I suspect that this little thing needs less. So I hope you don't mind me standing right over you. So here's what we see. The disciples in this case would then be trusting. They'd be innocent. They'd be childlike. In good ways. These are good qualities. But the crowds, on the other hand, the crowds who are especially led by the Pharisees, they're skeptical, they're self-righteous, they're self-reliant. And so what we find out is that there is a division. I really cannot figure this thing out. Maybe somebody could just sit back there and when I kind of do this signal, somebody hit a button. There it goes. Okay. So what parables do, And this is really fascinating to me. What parables do seems to divide between the trusting, the innocent, and the childlike, and the skeptical, the self-righteous, and the self-reliant. So it's almost like he's erecting a wall there that divides between these two groups. Now, have you ever heard a Bible teacher who you suspect is a little bit skeptical, self-righteous, or self-reliant? I know that I have. And to me, it seems like when we hear parables taught by, you know, people that might be a little bit self-righteous, we get all kinds of different approaches. We get different interpretations. And so I think this is what parables are designed for, is to divide between those who are innocent, they're trusting, and they're childlike, to divide those from those who are self-righteous and self-reliant. Now, I mean, you may say, well, how does this work? Well, here's how I think it was working for the disciples, is Jesus would say something very enigmatic. He'd say something very mysterious, and what did the disciples do? Well, they did exactly what we just saw them do in chapter 13. They went to Jesus and said, Jesus, what are you talking about? And so that right there, that action divided between those that wanted to go deeper, Those that wanted to have fellowship with Jesus between those who were self-reliant, self-righteous, because they were not going to go and subject themselves to sit at Jesus' feet. They were self-righteous, self-reliant. So it's a dividing line between the two. So parables counsel the trusting, the innocent, and the childlike, but they confuse the skeptical, the self-righteous, and the self-reliant. And by the way, I believe this is still happening in the world today. I don't think Jesus' parables just stopped doing this when he left the earth. I think this still happens today, that there are things sort of wrapped up and mysterious in the parables that if you approach them with a self-righteous mindset, you're going to go off in a lot of bizarre directions. So, Jesus taught in parables to reveal heavenly secrets, but notice, I think there's a little bit more. It's to reveal heavenly secrets to the trusting. He wanted to reveal those secrets to those who would get close to him, who would want to fellowship with him, those that would ask him questions. But it seems that parables are designed to hide those secrets from the self-righteous. That is fascinating to me. And to me, that says something about the brilliance of Christ, that he could craft stories in such a way that they would do exactly that. And I feel like that's exactly the same thing we see even today. So let's go on. Let's just take a look at what he says next. For whoever has, because these are the next verses, whoever has, to him more will be given, and he will have abundance, but whoever does not have, even what he has, will be taken away from him. Now, I'm just going to admit, a lot of times when I come to passages like this, I realize that I'm thinking about where I left my car keys, or I'm thinking about other things, because it feels like word soup. And so, we have to slow down sometimes when Jesus says things that kind of have these flipping and flopping concepts in them. We have to think, what is he talking about? So I'm going to give you my best stab at what I think he's saying here by inserting brackets. And by the way, brackets are not part of the verse. They're just my way of trying to help interpret what I think he is saying. And like I said yesterday, I'm very comfortable with I don't know, but I think this is what he's saying. There might be other interpretations. But notice this line, but whoever does not have. Now, who in the world does not have anything in a spiritual sense? I mean, who is that absolutely true of? Well, I would say that would be unbelievers, right? Unbelievers do not have, and we might even could go so far as to say, since he's talking about parables, it might be those who are even resisting belief, but let's just say unbelievers to be safe. And so what I'd put in brackets here, I'd say, but whoever does not have eternal life, even what he has will be taken away from him. Again, this is not working. So Don, even what he has will be taken away from him. So even what he has, and what I put in brackets here is his life, his temporal, physical life. Now, is this an absolute rule for every unbeliever that their life is going to be cut short? No, but remember the context that Jesus is talking about. He's talking about why he uses parables and the effect that those parables will have on certain people. So, but whoever does not have eternal life, even what he has, which is this life, will be taken away from him. So, that's the second half. Now, I want to jump back to the first half and see if we can make sense of that. For whoever has. Now, who in the world has something, at least some basic, we'll call it commodity in a spiritual sense? Well, the most basic thing we can have if we've believed in Jesus is eternal life. So, whoever has, and in brackets I'm going to put, I'm going to put eternal life. So, for whoever has eternal life, to him, and then I'm going to put another thing in brackets for this line, to him more will be given. And I think that more probably is talking about rewards now and in heaven. So let's just read this all together. It's sort of a Frankenstein version now. And by the way, there may be other ways to interpret this, but this seems to be what he's saying and what happens with the parables. It's sort of the wall that he builds with parables. For whoever has eternal life, to him more reward now and in heaven will be given, and he will have abundance. Now, we understand that if that's the case, if that's what he means, then it requires a childlike faith both for entrance into heaven, but also to have that abundance, to go deeper, to have fellowship, to gain rewards. But notice what he says next, but whoever does not have eternal life, even what he has, which is this life, will be taken away from him. It seems to me that that dividing line is part of what he's doing with parables. He's hiding from those who are skeptical, those who are self-reliant, what they could have. And in that, he is keeping this division. So, Jesus taught in parables to reveal heavenly secrets to the trusting, but hide them from the self-righteous, but notice this one, to teach believers how to have abundant life. I mean, I think that's why he brings it up here, is that those that listen, those that come to these parables and pay attention and subject themselves to Jesus' teaching humbly, what they can gain from parables is gaining a more abundant life. We would probably call that eternal reward. And what you'll notice as you go through the parables is so many of the parables are talking about eternal reward. It just makes sense of the parables. If you think every parable is talking about how to get salvation, you're going to be confused about, you know, most of them, maybe 90% or something like that. So this is another thing that we get from parables, is those that approach them in the way that Jesus explains, with that sort of childlike faith, they can learn how to have an abundant life. Now notice what he says just right after that. He says, therefore, I speak to them in parables. Okay, so he's still answering the same question. All of this so far is answering the same question. Therefore, I speak to them in parables because hearing they do not hear, nor do they understand, lest they should understand with their hearts and turn so that I should cure them. Now, one of the things I think we probably want to identify here is who are the they? Who is it that doesn't turn? Well, it's pretty important to recognize who Jesus' ministry was to. Jesus said he came to the lost sheep of Israel, right? So when we're talking about they, we're talking about those who he's ministering to, those he's preaching to, and maybe some Gentiles heard him, but primarily we're talking about the Jews. We're talking about those in Israel. So why wouldn't God want the Jews to turn to Jesus and be cured? Now, there are those that maybe go in for replacement theology or the idea that the church has replaced Israel, and they would answer this way different than I'm going to answer it. So don't get afraid. I'm not going to go that way because I don't think that's the answer. I don't think Jesus is saying that God has turned his back on Israel because he no longer is going to use Israel. I think he has a different plan altogether. So why wouldn't God want the Jews to turn to Jesus to be cured? Well, we actually have a explanation right here. Notice what he says, and this again is just the chapter right before in Matthew 12. He warned them not to make him known. Okay, so this is pretty close to the same time if you go with the chronology here. He warned them not to make him known, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, behold, my servant whom I have chosen, he will declare justice to the Gentiles till he sends forth justice to victory, and in his name Gentiles will trust. That's a really interesting statement to me, because Jesus was not there to personally preach to Gentiles, right? I mean, his ministry, he even identified his ministry is to talk to Jews, to talk to the sheep of Israel. So, how many Gentiles did Jesus preach to? Well, we don't technically know. We know that Jesus did minister to a few Gentiles. I can think of two, maybe three. The woman in Tyre and Sidon, he interacted with her, and apparently she knew who he was, and so maybe she had heard his preaching. There was a centurion that he did a miracle for, so apparently he knew who he was. So maybe Gentiles were hearing to some extent, but Jesus' ministry was to Jews. So we can pretty confidently say, as far as who he has declared justice to, because that's what the verse says, how many of those has he declared justice to directly preach to? None that we know of. At least that wasn't his purpose when he was preaching, as far as we can tell. So we have a dilemma with that verse. How is it that Jesus is going to declare justice to the Gentiles, and in his name the Gentiles trust or believe? He will declare justice to the Gentiles till in his name Gentiles will trust. Well, when does he do that? When in his ministry does he go out to Rome or to Ephesus or to any of the other Roman cities? Well, we don't have it during his earthly ministry. So when is this verse going to be fulfilled. When is that going to happen? Well, I think we have a clue for why wouldn't God want the Jews to turn in this whole concept in Romans. Oh, I just lost my feed back there. I might have to turn my back to you. My feed died there. Okay, so here's what Paul says in Romans. He says, blindness in part has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. And so all Israel will be saved. As it is written, the deliverer will come out of Zion and he will turn away ungodliness from Jacob. That is fascinating to me because this began during Jesus' ministry. But the world of Gentiles did not turn to Christ during his earthly ministry, right? So this has to continue from, you know, after Jesus leaves, during Paul's ministry, and so on and so forth. And that's why we call it, or that's one of the names for it, is the church age. And so what I see in this is that Jesus performed his ministry in a certain way so that those who are already kind of predisposed to disbelieve Jesus would be more hardened, that their unbelief would be intensified, because he had a plan. He had a plan for, I'm guessing most of us in the room are Gentiles, he had a plan for us to come in. And that required, in his plan, there to be a type of blindness for the Jews against their Messiah for a time. But here's the problem with replacement theology. Here's the problem with thinking that God has replaced Israel with the church. Notice what it says, blindness in part has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. Until, not forever, but for a while, there's a blindness. But what we find next is this amazing, and I look forward to the day this happens, and so all Israel will be saved as it is written. So this is God's plan. There is a time for Gentiles, and then at some point, and I personally believe it might have already happened, but there's a time that he's focusing on bringing Gentiles in, and then there's a time when God is going to turn his attention back to Israel. And I'm not going to get into all of that right now, but that's what we see in these verses. So I think this is the answer to this question we're looking for. Why wouldn't God want the Jews to turn to Christ and to be healed? He does, just not yet. It's going to happen, but it's going to happen in the future because he wants Gentiles too. I mean, Jesus, part of Jesus' ministry was to bring Gentiles in too. It just so happens that that was not during his 3 years on earth. There was going to be a phase called the church age where that happens. And so to me, this is another purpose for parables. You say, why are we talking about this again? I forgot. Because parables. Because I think that one of the reasons Jesus was speaking in parables, or actually it seems like this is what Jesus is saying, that one of the reasons he was speaking in parables is because those who were predisposed to disbelieve him, he wanted to intensify that. He wanted to harden that in the same way that Pharaoh hardened his heart, but then after that, chronologically, God sort of intensified that hardening in Pharaoh. I think he's doing this. He was doing the same thing in Israel by parables. So the way I put it is, Jesus taught in parables to intensify Israel's rejection for a while, so that Gentiles would have time to believe. And we have. I mean, we are the product of Jesus's parables, in a sense, if you think of it in that way, that we are here because Jesus didn't overwhelm the wits of Israel. I mean, he could have probably done certain things to just make Israel submit, but he didn't do it that way. He did it this way, I believe, because he wants us in the kingdom as well. So that is the people of the parables. But it's not quite the end, because I'm ready to give you the piece of paper that we have. Krista, my wife, and my son or daughter, she's pregnant, and so my wife and my son or daughter is going to pass out this sheet. Now, like I said, it's got color on it. I'm going to show you, if I can pull it up here. Oh, that's hard to read there, so we're not going to worry too much about reading. You'll have it in front of you. And again, I didn't put this up here so you can read it on the screen. I put it just so we can kind of have some reference, because I want to talk through this. This is an incomplete tool. And what I mean by incomplete is there are probably ways to improve this chart. And so this is a work in progress. I've never actually published this. It's just something that we're kind of working on. We may do a book at some point, or, you know, some more teaching on it. But this is the best way I can figure out to explain to people how parables not only stand alone, but also fit together. And so my pursuit in this was to try to figure out what aspects do we see in virtually all of the parables. So that's kind of the answer we're going to be looking for. Now let me just explain what you see on this sheet. So up here, I have highlighted sections here. Up here in the top right, there's kind of a description of what this sheet is. And you'll notice a little box with black dots and little squares. If you've never heard of a QR code, what that is if you take your phone, you point it at that thing, that is going to bring up a web page. And on that web page, you can download this, but you can also watch a number of videos of sermons on the parables. Now, I don't know that Bob Bryant knows this, but I've put some of videos from him on that page. I've got some videos from me teaching on various parables. Because, by the way, a lot of what I've learned comes from learning under Bob. And so I've got a number of his videos on there, a number of my videos on there. And so if you're interested in looking at how to teach parables, I think this is a great resource. So you can download this sheet there. You can look at videos. Now, let's just talk a little bit about what is on this chart. So I've divided this up into different sections. These are, on this chart, these parables are not in order in any way that you probably would recognize. They're not in chronological order. They're not in the order that Jesus gave them. They're categorized. They're like grouped up together because of certain similarities. And so the first three, I call these full spectrum parables. Okay. The next, and I'll explain why in a minute. The next I call life change parables. And you'll notice that 9 and 10 actually splits one parable into two lessons. And I acknowledge it's one parable, but there seems to be two lessons in the parable of the prodigal son. So I actually put those two lessons in different sections. That's a little weird. Maybe somebody can help me figure out how to do it better, but that's the best way I could figure out how to do it. The next section is, let's see, I skipped one. The next section is seems to me to be about character revealed. The section after that seems to be about salvation or condemnation. And the next section, salvation. So these are the parables that talk about salvation only, or you could say those who are justified. And then the last section you'll see there, there's just, did I just put dots or just sort of empty spaces, not specified, because I think these are just about general principles. We can learn something from them, but they don't quite fit in the rest. And then down at the bottom, you'll see the references. So you could go through this, you could look at various ones, and then you can get to the passage, there. So I want to talk a little bit about how am I doing on time? I haven't seen a time card. Anybody have any clue what time we're supposed to be done? Okay, so we're doing okay. You said 10:10, we got to be done? All right. If me and Bob are in charge of time, then I don't know. Just keep going. Okay, that's all I needed to know. Thank you. You might as well have given me an algebraic formula just now. I don't know what you just said. So 10, we'll stop at 10. Okay. So this header to me is a way of understanding most of the aspects that we see in parables, or at least maybe we could say most of the things that it seems Jesus wants to teach. Now you'll notice in the left square or the second left square, it says parables and illustrations. And the reason why I included illustrations is because lessons from Jesus on this list of 40, some people don't call them parables. And so there's some debate on some of these on whether it's a parable or it's just like an object lesson. I went ahead and put them all on there and just sort of broadened the net and said it's either a parable or it's an illustration. Most of them, everybody agrees they're parables. Some of them might actually be an object lesson or an illustration. Now what you'll see next to that is two main categories, not saved and eternally saved. Here we're talking about the difference between people who have eternal life and those who don't. You might say justified and the unjustified or whatever. Those who are going to be in the kingdom of heaven as opposed to those who will be in the lake of fire for eternity. So those are two big divisions. But here's the part that many teachers seem to miss, that there are divisions underneath those who are eternally saved. Now, I've decided to call these failed disciple and successful disciple, but we could call this something else. I know that some might use a term like carnal Christians or something like that, but ultimately what we're saying is they are eternally saved, but there are some who are going to succeed at being overcomers or being rewarded, and there are some who aren't. And then underneath not saved, we just put unbeliever. Because if somebody's an unbeliever, we're not really all that concerned with their behavior if they haven't believed yet. So that's the heading, and hopefully that kind of makes sense. Now, what I want to do is talk quickly about a couple of the sections. So here's why I call these full spectrum, these first three full spectrum parables. I actually believe if you're going to teach through the parables, these three are the most important if you're trying to give kind of an overview of what parables are about, because you'll notice that they have something in every section. And so if you start on a different parable that maybe doesn't represent unbelievers, but it's just talking about failed disciples and successful disciples, what a lot of teachers do is they get confused because they automatically assume that pretty much all the parables are talking about who's saved and who's not saved. And then you get a really weird, wonky interpretation of the parable. So I think that the four soils is a great one to start on. And the reason why I say that, because in the four soils, I believe it's in the Luke version, it actually tells us that there's only one group that's unsaved. It says that there's one of the soils who doesn't believe, and there it says that otherwise they would believe and be saved. So I take that to mean you've got one group in that parable that is unsaved. The rest must be saved. So there we have unbelievers represented in that parable. We have failed disciples represented in that parable. And we have successful disciples. The successful disciples are the ones who produce the multitude of crop. And so I think that's a great one, because then we can begin to build from there as a foundation on the when we go to the other parables to try to figure out what are they talking about. Wedding banquet is a great one too. I love the 10 minas because it's the same way. So a lot of times what people will do is they'll go to the parable of the talents and they'll teach that kind of in isolation, and they might get a little confused because that unfaithful servant, you know, you could understand how some people would just automatically assume, oh, that might be somebody that's unsaved. Here's what I like to do with that. Go to the minas. Because in the minas, there's a fourth group, and I call it the citizens here. I think that's the word that's used in the parable. There's a fourth group who is totally executed. In the parable, they're executed. And so if that's the worst outcome, then the unfaithful servant who has a bad outcome, he doesn't have the worst outcome. So if the worst outcome is the lake of fire, then that slightly less worse outcome must not be being unsaved. It must be something else. So those are ones that I really love to start with, because I think they build a great framework for understanding the parables. So I think you probably, let me make a point on this one. So this arrow here, there's two different kinds of arrows on this chart. This arrow represents that this is not two different kinds of characters. This is one character who could either be a successful disciple or a failed disciple. Think about the sleeping servant or the watchful servant. That's the same servant. He's saying you ought to be watchful, but you could be sleeping if you're not careful. Or the lost sheep. The lost sheep and the found sheep are the same sheep. What's the singular of sheep? Is it sheep? It's the same sheep, I guess, but it's lost at one point, it's found in another. Lost coin the same way. Now, I think if there's something that you may disagree with me on, and I just acknowledge you might, that's okay. One thing you might disagree with me on is splitting the prodigal son parable. But let me just make the pitch for why I did this. I believe there's two lessons, or well, there's probably more, but there seems to be two really big lessons in the prodigal son story. It's connected with the lost sheep. It's connected with the lost coin. And then he goes into the prodigal son, who's basically a lost son. At the beginning of the story, you could say he's a found son. Then he becomes a lost son, and then he becomes a found son again. That's a beautiful message just by itself. But then notice what's tagged kind of at the end. It's this secondary lesson about, and I think it's directed at the Pharisees, at the false teachers. And what he's saying is, you can either be like the father who accepts the prodigal son, or you can be like the older brother. Now, a lot of people say God is the father in the prodigal son parable. And I say, yes, that he is an example of good spiritual leadership. But think about what Jesus is trying to have them do. He's trying to have them emulate the character that you see in the father. So you could say God is the father in the parable, but I also like to say, but that father could also represent good spiritual leadership. I mean, he's saying to the Pharisees, you ought to be like this father. You ought to accept those lost sheep. You ought to invite them back in. And so that's why I kind of divide that, because I think it really works as two lessons. A lot of the parables maybe have multiple lessons. And if you disagree with me on that, I love you anyway, and that's totally fine. That's not a problem. Like I said, I'm still kind of figuring out some of this, and that's why it fits into a workshop rather than something else. So the next section, character revealed, that's the one we're kind of looking at there, and you kind of get the idea on the others. Let me see if I can advance here to, it's kind of cutting my word off there for some reason, but this section would be salvation or condemnation. You get the idea there. Now the arrows on that one are for a little bit of a different reason. What I'm saying with those arrows in the section that is 23 through 30, which is salvation or condemnation, what I'm saying is he doesn't seem to specify whether they're successful disciples or failed disciples. It seems like in these, seven or eight, he's talking about whether someone has eternal salvation or not. Now, what you'll notice is we've got 40 parables or illustrations, and only 23 through 36 seem to be talking about whether or not someone is saved. And even that might be debatable. I mean, some of these we might look at and say, I'm not sure that's what that one's talking about. But that's where I put them, because they seem to be talking about that. So that's that. I think that's a valuable lesson to remember when we're talking about parables, that they're not all about whether or not someone is saved, and maybe even less than I've got here are. This section, salvation only, we might could say the same thing, because these are only about salvation in a certain sense. Like, for instance, mustard seed. I think the mustard seed, the leaven, the treasure, I think these are all talking about the kingdom. So it's not quite accurate to say they're talking about a specific believer, but I just didn't know how else to put it together. Again, maybe somebody has a good idea on that. So I think what he's saying is this mustard seed will grow into something great. I think he's saying the kingdom will grow into something great. So that is believers. I mean, the kingdom is believers, but it's not a perfect fit on the chart. So maybe we need another like dangling section over to the side or something. I don't know. So anyway, that is the basic concept here. These last general principles, each of these teach something, but if you try to figure out whether the Good Samaritan is saved or not, I don't think he really comments on whether he is. Like, if we said that's about salvation, then we're probably all going to go to hell, because the Good Samaritan was gooder than all of us, you know? So I think these are more just talk, because he was answering that one, the question of who is my neighbor. I think he's giving a general principle. So those seem to be general principles. Oh, I feel like I've been talking like 1,000 miles an hour, but I'm almost done. I think that's about it. Is that my last slide? That's my last slide. Okay. Let the Inquisition begin. Let me just reiterate this. You can ask me questions, but I am not the foremost expert on parables in the room. There are probably a bunch of really great teachers here. So what I want to do in the next few minutes is you can pick this apart. You can give me ideas, because I am trying to develop this in the way that it's the most useful tool. I'm probably not even going to defend it to you. I'm interested to know, how does this sit with you? Maybe ideas on how to improve it, whatever. So the floor is open, whatever you think. Yes, sir.
Very good. These are the parables of the kingdom. Now, if you believe that the kingdom is not yet future, how does this fit into the church age? Or is it the kingdom here but not yet?
Yeah, boy. I don't know if I can repeat that question. Let's see. Let me see if I can kind of reword it. Help me reword it. But it feels like we're saying, how do we teach the kingdom if we're focused on, people of the parables? Is that kind of your concept? Or your face is telling me no.
Say it again.
How does it apply to the kingdom?
The kingdom is future.
Yeah.
And these are about the kingdom. That would mean that all these apply to the kingdom future. How does that apply now?
Gotcha. Okay. So he's saying, if they apply to the kingdom future, how do they apply to what's going on today, right?
The use of the word kingdom, how is it narrow or broad?
Are you asking me my personal interpretation of that?
Yeah.
That would be easier. Why don't I just do that? Okay. So when Jesus talks about the kingdom, I just take that to be future kingdom. millennial and eternal state. But I think there's still principles that we gain from them today, because, you know, my experience in the kingdom is going to be very much determined on how I live in this temporal church age. So are they about the kingdom future? I think so. But they also very much apply to me. Otherwise, why would we need to focus on them? And they're very applicable. So many of the parables to me are about reward. They're about what a successful disciple gets. So I don't know. I don't know if I'm really capturing the question, but maybe we could talk some more later. Straighten me out and help me figure out, you know, where to go with that. Other thoughts or questions? Yeah, Michael. Yeah.
And it doesn't say so. It hints through it, because how Peter was so reluctant to let the Gentiles in was—is there any hint in there to think, no, if these guys got saved, they wouldn't let the Gentiles in, and I want.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Okay, so yeah, what he's saying is that. Yeah, you could kind of see. Okay, let me see if I can kind of restate that. So you could kind of see a potential where. Let me go to John 2. Okay, so what I believe was happening in John 2, John 2 tells us that there were many that believed in his name, but Jesus did not entrust himself to them. And what I take that to mean is Jesus didn't fellowship with him. I mean, I think they had eternal life. They believed in him. They saw his miracles, and then they were like, that's got to be the Messiah. They believed in him. They believed in him for eternal life. But he didn't entrust himself to him because, what does it say? He knew it was in a man. He knew that even though they're believers, I think this may be kind of what you're getting at, even though they believed in him, they could turn on him, they could mess up the plan, I mean, all kinds of things. And maybe there's something in that if he were to reveal so clearly to the Jews who potentially could turn on him, they could believe but still restrict Gentiles from coming in. Because that was the mindset at the time, was God is not for the Gentiles. Yeah, there you go.
To finally say, okay, Gentiles.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. That's a whole angle I didn't even think of. Other thoughts or questions or comments? Yes, sir.
Could the parable of the prodigal son also be a pseudo chronology of a believer born? Start out in your father's house and under his teaching, go out into the world. Hmm.
I could see that. Yeah.
And the older brother would actually be a warning to those who stayed within the fold to not become jealous of that.
I could see that. And since you said, could it be, I'd say, yeah, I think it definitely could be. I could see it that way. I tend to think, I don't know that I would really disagree with what you've said. I think probably it's pretty similar to the way that I think of it. The way I think of it is, the son who becomes lost was a son at the beginning. He knows where he ought to be. He knows the father. So I take that to mean he's a believer. He represents a believer. He goes out into the world, messes up, comes back, still a believer the whole time, still saved the whole time, accepted back in. The difficulty for me, and I still wrestle with this, is the older brother represents people who are saved or unsaved. And that's hard. I don't even remember what I said on that. I wrestled with this. I put the older brother in the category of failed disciple. But I don't know that for sure. And so it's possible that older brother ought to be in the unsaved category. What do you guys think? Do you think the older brother represents a saved person or?
Pharisee.
Pharisee, which generally meant unsaved, right? I mean, unbeliever. Yeah.
I think he even directed it to them because they were the ones that wouldn't welcome. It's like, how could you let that person in?
Sure.
Not?
Yeah. So, but there are some instances of Pharisees that believed. So it could be a Pharisee that then needs to step up into mature spiritual leadership. So that's a possibility. JB, did you have a thought?
The first son was saved. Why wouldn't the second son?
Yeah. Yeah. So that would agree with my category. So I like that. Yeah. Do you have a thought?
Represent
quarterback could represent a believer who's been working in the church for many years, and then there's this other person that may have been in the church, then he goes off, he comes back, and then the older brother is not willing to welcome him back in, back into the church.
Yeah. See, I think that's about where I am on it, because if the older brother represented an unbeliever, I don't know that Jesus would expect that older brother. I mean, in a sense, Jesus' teaching is mostly for believers, right, to mature. And so that's why I kind of lean toward him being a believer. I don't mean to call, spotlight you, but what do you think, Bob, the older brother? The other one, yeah. Yeah. But then we have all kinds of other problems. Yeah. 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 Yeah, that's really what I struggled with when I was putting that one together, was like, because everybody, most Free Grace people are saying the younger son, the prodigal son, is a believer. Well, that would have to, if that's the qualification, that he's a son, therefore a believer, then you'd have to do the same with that. You reminded me of that. That's good. Okay, I got a card. Let's see what it says.
That's an online question.
Okay. You have lovely shoes. No, I'm just kidding. For new believers, should we teach them the parables in a particular sequence? Oh, well, that's actually kind of part of what I'm trying to do. Okay, so, and then clarification. Don, who read the comment, said, I think it might be asking about easy ones to understand. So I want to say yes. I think if you're teaching them, like if you're teaching through Matthew, you're probably going to deal with them in the order they appear. And I understand that. But if you're teaching just parables, my personal, and this is just preference, but my personal preference is to pick from the first three that are on the list. That's why I put them in that order, because I think teaching the four soils, and specifically the four soils version that's in Luke, that's the one I like, because it has that line in there that the birds take the seed away. Otherwise, the seed represents the word. Otherwise, they would what? They would believe and be saved. I think that is so important to understand in that parable. And if you read it in the other Gospels, that line is not in all of them. So I like the version in Luke. Wedding banquet is a pretty big one. There's a lot to it. I don't know that I'd want to teach that one first, but I think for me, maybe the 10 minas and the four soils, to me, those are foundational for understanding parables. Bob and Sean have a great podcast on, maybe there was a couple of them, but a great podcast on the four soils, which I love. That'd be worth finding on faithalone.org. So there's lots of great resources on faithalone.org about parables. But yeah, so sequence, I would say one or a few of those ones that kind of cover the whole spectrum. Looks like we got maybe 3 minutes, because I think we're supposed to be done at 10:10. Any other ideas? Doesn't have to be a question. Other concepts or ideas on improving this concept, or experiences teaching the parables? Anybody have anything that you learned going through the parables that as you taught them? Okay.
Any particular parable that struck you as one that just emphasized?
Oh, that's a great question. So he's asking, is there any particular parable that emphasizes what we like to emphasize in Free Grace? It depends on how you teach it, but I think I would probably still answer the same way. I love the minas. I love the four soils. As long as you teach them, okay, so here's the problem. Lots of people teach these in a very lordship way. And so there's people who will have heard the parable of the minas. There's people who have heard the parables of the four soils like a dozen times from a lordship teacher. And they're going to then therefore think about it that way. But to me, that is, those are really great. The other ones, though, that come to mind are the lost sheep and the found sheep. Now, again, if you go to the way that a lordship teacher teaches them, it's going to confuse people. But I think we see assurance in the lost sheep, in the lost coin, because if they were, because like if you think about it, at the beginning, there's 100 sheep. So that sheep had to be part of the crew, part of the crew's not the herd. Had to be part of the herd. And so if it's a part of the 100 at the beginning, and then that becomes 99, it's always part of the 100 the whole time. And so to me, I see assurance in that. I see the kind of things that really attracted me to free grace. Kind of the same with the lost coin. The reason I like the lost coin is because the coin is mindless. The coin didn't lose itself. It just got displaced. And so there's you know, I don't know. I find that one really interesting. So yeah, I think for me it'd probably still be maybe 1 and 3, the 4 soils and 10 minas, and maybe adding in some of those others.
The peeps of the
parables. The peeps of the parables. That's pretty good. Yeah, that's, or we could call it the parapeeps.
No.
All right. Well, hey, it's 10:10. Thank you for listening. If anybody has more ideas, I'll be hanging around. So I'd love to hear your input or your thoughts. So thank you guys. Appreciate it.